This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is on assignment. Coming up, a national conference of the Black is Back Coalition addresses the issues raised by the resistance in Ferguson, Missouri. Mumia Abu-Jamal calls for 2-3 more Fergusons. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund calls on the U.S. Justice Department to investigate the killings of unarmed Black men, not just occasionally, but every time it happens. But first, the United States policy in Syria has been thrown into total disarray by the military successes of ISIS, the Islamic Caliphate. Washington has long supported Muslim fundamentalist jihadists who fight against regimes opposed by the United States. However, ISIS seems to have a mind of its own and has turned on the U.S. and its allies. We spoke with Dr. Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He says the proxy war against Syria by the U.S. and its friends has allowed ISIS to grow and thrive.
When you're engaged in a proxy war in Syria and that defines your foreign policy, it's actually impossible to see what the principal threat is to the region. The principal threat to the Kingdom of Jordan is not Syria, is not the Syrian government, is not the problem of authoritarianism versus democracy. The principal problem to Jordan is that they are liable to be destabilized by this wave called the Islamic State. After all, the Islamic State has its origins in the American destruction of Iraq in 2003. Following year, it was a Jordanian, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who moved from the town of Zarqa in Jordan. He had been imprisoned by the kingdom to Iraq, to the town of Tal Afar, where he started Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, you know, which then becomes the Islamic State. So there are a number of Jordanians in the Islamic State, and they're itching to come and destabilize Jordan. So what I'm saying is there's an actual tangible threat to the region from the Islamic State, which they themselves have fostered. You know, it's a classic case of blowback. But this tangible threat is not able to be dealt with because they are engaged and have been engaged for the last 3 years in an illusionary threat to themselves, which is the question of Syria and its internal affairs.
Well, you mentioned Jordan. Jordan is the headquarters of the U.S. Special Forces and clandestine effort to arm and train fighters in Syria.
Yes, exactly. This is the thing. You have the Kingdom of Jordan, which relies greatly on the United States for its security. The United States is not really able to create a full security apparatus, as we've seen. Its own strategy in dealing with Al-Qaeda is deeply flawed. I mean, everywhere where the United States pokes its stick, rather than weakening, Al-Qaeda strengthens. And the test case of that, of course, is Yemen and now in Iraq. I mean, United States went in there to so-called create freedom and instead created a huge base for Al-Qaeda. So Jordan, which has put its chips in with the United States, might want to seriously consider the long-term viability of its own security through its reliance on the United States. It might rather want to think about a more regional, robust compact between the states of the region against something as destabilizing as the Islamic State. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for overthrowing monarchies and transforming states into free republics for their citizens. Obviously, that's true. But the instrument of the Islamic State is not the strategy for creating a much more robust citizenry in the Arab world. In fact, the opposite. If you think things are bad now, they would be worse under the so-called Al-Khalifa of the Islamic State.
Mr. al-Baghdadi, the head of the caliphate, seemed to be warning the Saudis and Qataris and others that their legitimacy is in question and that the caliphate should supersede these monarchies in terms of the allegiance of Muslims.
Well, you know, again, he's not just threatened that. The very fact that he's declared a caliphate is an open declaration of war against Saudi Arabia, because the king of Saudi Arabia is a so-called custodian of the two mosques. In other words, he fashions the monarchy as the most important representative on earth of Islam, in a sense. And Baghdadi's move to create a caliphate has already directly threatened or questioned the legitimacy of Saudi Arabia. This and the issue of Jordan raises to the front the problem of their thinking. You know, they have been directly challenged, their legitimacy, their ideology, and now, of course, the Islamic State is threatening to create problems inside Saudi Arabia. And this is not a new threat. Saudi Arabia, of course, dealt with such threats in the 1970s, when the Masjid al-Haram was taken over by a group as radical, as, in a sense, crazy as the Islamic State. And, you know, then out of that came the emergence of Mr. bin Laden, also not exactly a Saudi, but as Saudi as you get. And then there was Al-Qaeda in Arabia. So they know what it feels like to have blowback, but for some mysterious reason, they prefer to indulge themselves by raising snakes and then later saying, oh my gosh, there's a snake, I have to kill it. If you do this 5 or 6 times, it's remarkable that your own population doesn't see through the facade.
Sounds like chickens coming home to roost. Does this spell the end of the U.S. policy of proxy war fighting in the region?
Well, you know, the U.S. policy right now is rather strange. You know, here's a situation when you've gone in and destroyed a state. You know, you've destroyed the state of Iraq, you've destroyed its air force. You've left it incapable of maintaining its own integrity. And then the United States comes in like a cowboy saying we're going to save the day. Of course, it doesn't. And that's the interesting thing. This is where the media has missed the story. You know, what the U.S. bombings did was they bombed the artillery stolen by the Islamic State from the Iraqi military in Mosul, which had been given to them by the Americans. So the Americans came in to bomb their own artillery, which was threatening their principal ally on the ground, and that is the Kurdish Republic in northern Iraq. Meanwhile, while all this high drama was happening, and Obama, I think, was being extremely paternalist, saying today America's coming to help, while all that was happening, from Turkey, from Syria, and from their bases in northern Iraq, emerged the Kurdish Workers' Party, which the United States claims is a terrorist organization, and their closest ally in Syria, the YPG. These two fought from Syria to create a land corridor into northern Iraq, and they rescued tens of thousands of the Yazidis who were trapped on Mount Sinjar. When the Americans finally got there with a helicopter drop of humanitarian aid, to greet them were not the desperate and helpless, you know, people of the Yazidi community, but it was PKK and the YPG who welcomed them in, accepted the aid, and said thank you very much. So in a sense, the idea that America is going to come to solve the problem or that America is so needed has been rendered superfluous or useless by the actual practice of these Kurdish militias, which have exerted themselves to save their own country. So the question of American intervention being the only question on the table is no longer relevant. And I think people of some intelligence need to recognize that when America says things like, today America's coming to help, nobody really should be fooled into believing that people in places like Iraq are not capable of helping themselves.
And now the Shiite-dominated government of Iraq is even more militarily dependent upon Iran, and the Russians are helping to reconstitute the Iraqi Air Force.
Well, this is the thing. You know, you have an interesting situation here. You have a group like the Islamic State, which has constructed itself to battle against and defeat conventional warfare. You know, they are not fazed by aerial bombardment because they can vanish in an instant. So the one organization that has actually threatened them on the ground and has been threatening them on the ground for the last 2 years, you know, has not allowed them to enter their enclave in northwestern Syria, is the YPG, which is the group closely linked to the Workers' Party of Kurdistan. They have fought off the Islamic State from the ground. Their militia battles them on the road that links the city of Raqqa in Syria to the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi in Iraq. So, you know, whether the Iraqi armed forces, they have now better aerial defense, etc., these things are not really what has on the ground demonstrated is effective against the Islamic State. So until the morale of the Iraqi army has been raised, until the morale of the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga is raised, they are not going to be able to tackle the Islamic State. You need fighters with morale. It's something that I think every American should remember, that over the last decade and a bit, the United States has destroyed three state institutions, the state in Afghanistan, the state in Iraq, and the state in Libya. You know, we used our immense firepower to wreck these three states. You can destroy a state in an afternoon, but it takes 100 years to build institutions. It takes 100 years to build people's sense of morale in the institutions. It's very easy to destroy them. It's very hard to build them up. So just simply sending weapons or aid to the Iraqi government is not the same as watching the institution build up and seeing people have faith in the institutions.
Well, the Obama administration's main antidote to ISIS seems to be the $500 million, $500 million it wants from Congress to create more so-called moderate Syrian fighters.
Yeah, that's the oldest joke in the world, you know, because every time the West has created a so-called moderate Syrian fighting force, that moderate Syrian fighting force has very happily taken the money and then vanished. The most recent instantiation was the so-called Southern Front, which was going to emerge from the city of Daraa and challenge Damascus. You know, they were heavily funded. They were trained in a so-called secret base in eastern Jordan, and they got a huge amount of unspecified amount of money. The people I talked to said that they had the best equipment, etc. Well, the equipment disappears and the fighters make no impact at all because the city of Daraa is isolated and the approach to Damascus is completely blocked off. So yes, you know, the United States Congress can delude itself. They can deploy a huge amount of funds. They can send trainers, whatever. But on the ground, they are having no impact. The Free Syrian Army has become basically a shell of what it was assumed it would be. It has deteriorated into capturing people for ransom. This is a huge problem that they face. Their legitimacy has declined. Meanwhile, the groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, etc., are continuing to prosecute a highly ideological war. You know, they don't really care what people think of them. They are happy to post gruesome videos on YouTube because this is exactly their sectarian logic. So they are gaining because their morale is high. They are fighting for something they believe in. The Free Syrian Army and other cutouts of the U.S. Congress have long lost the belief in what they are doing. So it's about time for the American people to recognize that, yes, certainly it's true. The Assad government is no panacea, no great paradise. But right now, stability in Syria is essential. Assad needs to publicly make declarations, which he occasionally does, but then he walks back from them, you know, that he will respect the rights of all Syrians. He will give a full amnesty. There has to be a way to bring some order to retain the semblance of the Syrian state in order to prosecute a proper isolation of the Islamic State.
But that would require that the United States and its allies recognize the Syrian state as something that is going to stay, to remain.
Well, you know, if they don't do that, then we're going to see this kind of chaos continue for a very long time. And in a way, it may suit their purposes to allow this chaos to continue. On the one side, it allows them to say, well, look, Muslims are just like this. It allows them to feed off the Islamophobia that's growing in these societies. That's true. It also allows them to have countries in the region feel very insecure, countries like Iraq and, of course, in the Gulf, and therefore have less of a political voice in the region against, for instance, Israeli bombing. I mean, in a different era when Israel would have bombed like this, even the countries that are less militant, Saudi Arabia, etc., would have been far more effective or ferocious in their condemnation. But because they are all deeply worried about the chaos in the region, their condemnation of this very barbaric bombing campaign against Gaza was almost virtually mute. You know, to say that what they see as war crimes is hardly a radical statement. That seemed a statement of fact, but they were not willing to do anything about it. So, you know, it may suit the purposes of the West to allow a certain amount of chaos. It makes the political will of these countries much less than it should be. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's terrible for the world, and it's very dangerous. You know, chaos is not the way people should be allowed to live.
Dr. Vijay Prashad at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held its annual conference in Philadelphia this past weekend. Among the speakers was Larry Hamm of the Newark, New Jersey-based People's Organization for Progress, POP, which is part of the Black is Back Coalition. POP will hold a march on Wednesday in solidarity with the struggle in Ferguson.
You know, in Ferguson, Missouri, they quelled the struggle, at least temporarily. They shut down the local police department and put a black state trooper over the police in Ferguson. And for a moment, people calmed down. You see how I made that immediate effect? It had to put somebody black. But then what did they do? Folks are so stupid, right? Maybe they just was upset because the black man seemed to calm things down. They turn around and impose a curfew on people, try to impose a state of emergency and a police state instead of using their efforts to try to get justice for Michael Brown. So the people rose up again, and they should continue to rise up until they get justice for Michael Brown. Let Ferguson be a signal to black people and people who want justice all over this country. Let it be a signal. Let it be a flare that goes into the heavens so that everybody all around the country will see what we need to do. This is what we need to do. We need to get back into the streets, and we need to stay in the streets as long as it takes to get justice. In Newark, New Jersey, after all the years that the People's Organization for Progress has been struggling around the issue of police brutality, in Newark, New Jersey, the Justice Department,
yes,
announced that it had done a 3-year study. And what did the Justice Department say? They said that 75% of the stop and frisk in Newark, New Jersey were unconstitutional. And that although black people make up 54% of Newark's population, they were 85% of the stop and frisk.
Yeah.
What did the Justice Department say? It said that the Newark Police Department had engaged in the use of excessive force and had abused people's constitutional rights. And on top of it, what did the Justice Department say? It said that the gang unit and the drug unit of the Newark Police Department stole the drugs and the cash of the same people they were arresting in the streets. And what did the Justice Department recommend? That the Newark Police Department be put under a federal monitor. A federal monitor. And more than that, they even recommended something that we've been calling for, and that is civilian oversight. We say more specifically, we want a police review board in Newark, New Jersey with subpoena powers, investigatory powers, and the power to punish police use our constitutional rights. In New York City, they're demanding that Bratton step down in the aftermath of Eric Garner, and they're demanding a new police commission. Ferguson is two-thirds black. Two-thirds. They got 56 police in the department. Only three are black. So they put a black man, a state trooper, he ain't even in the local police, they put him in charge. So people are making demands, and we support all the demands for change that people are making. But brothers and sisters, we must understand this, that police brutality is not caused by a few aberrant rogue cops. It is a systemic problem. It arises out of the system of social and economic and political oppression that we live under. Why is it that police brutality persists? New York has a police review board, and they still have police brutality. There are 13 cities in the country that have police review. Why does it persist? It persists because the use of violence against black people has been necessary and condoned since the creation of the United States of America. We cannot have a system of slavery in place without the most extreme force. You cannot steal land and take the land of the indigenous people without the use of extreme force. The use of force against people of color, black people, and the indigenous has been codified in law. It was part of the law. And although it may not be the law anymore, it is so deep in the psychosocial fabric of the United States of America. They don't need a law. They know if they hire these police that they are going to abuse, and brutalize black people. And the police brutality will continue. It will continue after we get a police review board in Newark, even though we're fighting for the police review board. Because the police are part and parcel of a system of racial control that has existed in this country since African people were first brought here. And the answer does not lie just in the reforms that we are fighting for. The answer lies in revolution.
But we must fight. This country has moved so far to the right. Do you know what was on the front page of the New York Times this week? I thought it was a picture from Gaza. It was a picture from Ferguson, Missouri. It was a picture of what I thought was soldiers. They were not soldiers. They were the police, but they were in soldiers' uniform. They were in equipment, in vehicles that were military vehicles. They were using weapons such as tear gas guns that were used by the military. If you look at the picture, you would think that it was Gaza, but it was not Gaza. It was the United States of America. And you know, Obama can't go around the world telling people about how they should handle their business when you got tear gas and soldiers in the streets of, where is it? Are we in Kansas? Are we back in St. Louis, Missouri? So you hear on the news them talking about the militarization of the police forces. Brothers and sisters, this is not new. This is not new. The militarization of the police. The militarization of the police in its most contemporary form
started in response to our rebellions in the 1960s. Last month, July, was the anniversary of the North Rebellion. It was a rebellion. It wasn't a riot. A riot could have been put down in a few hours by the police. A riot involves a small number of people. A rebellion involves a whole people, a whole section of the population. And you can't put it down in a day. You can't put it down in a few days. When the 1967 North Rebellion happened, the North Police Force was 1,300 strong. They couldn't put it down. They had to call in 700 state troopers. Police and troopers combined couldn't put it down. They had to call in the National Guard. It took the police, the state troopers, the National Guard, and for Governor Hughes to declare martial law to put down the Newark Rebellion. And when the rebellion did subside, did people stop? No. Within martial law, Newark, New Jersey, a Black Power Conference was held. 2 weeks later in Detroit. Detroit, a much larger city. Detroit with thousands of members on its police force. They couldn't put down the Detroit Rebellion. They had to call in thousands of state troopers. The police, the state troopers, couldn't put down the rebellion. Governor Romney, Mitt Romney's father, called in the National Guard. The National Guard, the state police, and the local Detroit police could not put down the Detroit Rebellion. What did they have to get? They had to go to Vietnam and get the 82nd Airborne in Vietnam, bring it back home. And it took the 82nd Airborne, the National Guard, the state troopers, and the police to put down the Detroit Rebellion. We are a revolutionary people. Capitalism is always trying to function in a more efficient and effective way. They can't send the army to every city. There ain't enough army to send to every city. If every city in America, you know, there were over 1,000 uprisings in the United States between 1960 and 1972. And even when that period was over, we didn't stop rising up. We rose up in Miami, Florida. We rose up in Los Angeles. And we're rising up in Ferguson, Missouri today. And we're going to keep rising up as long as we're oppressed. But they can't send the army. So what did they do? With the election of Nixon in 1968, they formed the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And they begin to funnel. This is in a book called No Left Turns that came out in the beginning of the 70s. They begin to funnel millions of dollars to local police forces to beat them up. And then more than that, they begin to create a seamless national police force. See, we look at the police and we say, oh, that's the Philadelphia police. And that's the North Police. And that's the state. They are one police, brothers and sisters. One police. And what they have been doing since our uprisings in the 70s is integrating their command and control structures more and more and more. They even begin to make each other look like each other. At one point in Newark, they were making the local police cars look like the state police cars. But even beyond that, now you go to Newark, New Jersey, it's not just local police that patrol Newark streets. The sheriff's police are patrolling. The state police are coming in too. And you think that this is just for your safety. No, this is preparation. They know, they read the same stuff we know. They might know it better than we know it. They know that people in this country are not going to go for this forever. They are training units of the U.S. Army right now as we speak, preparing them for urban uprisings and maybe even suburban uprisings all across this country. They know what's happening. People are sick and tired of being sick and tired. They're shooting our people down in the street like dogs. They're treating us worse than dogs. Closing our schools, closing our hospitals, closing the factories and sending them overseas, foreclosing on our homes, jailing our young people at a rate that no other country does in the world. The United States has more people in its jails than China. China has four times the population. China, Iraq, and Iran don't have as many people in prisons as the United States. And today, in the United States of America, more black people are under the authority of the criminal justice system than were enslaved in the United States in 1860. It's not a Jim Crow. It's a new enslavement. It's a new form of slavery that's going on. But I close with this. They can build their prisons. They can beef up their police. They can create a national police force. They can create more intelligence agencies. They can build a bigger army, but no matter what they do, the people will struggle against oppression. And ultimately, we don't know the day, we don't know the hour, but I guarantee you, we will transform this capitalist and imperialist system that we live under. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress, speaking at the Black is Back Coalition Annual Conference in Philadelphia. Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela says the Black Liberation Movement is becoming energized once again after being crushed by the oppressive forces of the American state two generations ago.
We did suffer a military defeat, and I don't think we can get around the fact that that happened. And we've had two generations of African people who have had to try to exist without the benefit of the leadership of revolutionary organization and activity subsequent to the 1960s. And in the wake of that vacuum, all kinds of silliness has been able to create a certain kind of influence. Some of it are people who are hired to do it, who make their living, are sowing confusion, and, you know, we can call them by names if we were so inclined. Some of them rooted in certain kinds of superstitions that would not allow them to come forward with the political program that has its basis in the actual conditions that our people and the peoples of the world have to be confronted with. And I think that what we are experiencing with this coalition is a certain kind of resurrection of the unity that's necessary to forge a revolutionary movement and a resurrection of a scientific approach to struggle. And when I say science, I'm talking about we see analysis coming forward that is falsifiable. And that's the only thing that you can call scientific. Somebody can stand here and say that in the beginning there was the Word and the Word was God. Well, that's not scientific because you can't falsify that. You understand? There's nothing you can do and say, well, if there was not the Word, such and such would have happened. But people who stood here before us today, in many instances, they've offered us empirical data, empirical evidence of how the world looks and how it functions. And this is why we must have a particular stand in the world. It's falsifiable. Because we can say that if it were not true that our conditions as African people, police violence and all of that is a consequence of the creation and development of state apparatus that were required necessarily to keep us enslaved people under control, if that were not true, then we couldn't have a good explanation for why the prisons are filled with black people, why Ferguson is not unusual, why in every community that we know the same thing happens, and if it were not true, then the same thing happening to us would be happening to white people. But it doesn't happen, because the police is in the white community, the police is in the black community, but it only does what it does in our community. It's falsifiable. You can make me a lie by showing me the data that says the same thing is happening to our communities that's happening in their community. You can make me a lie that when I say that this is colonialism that we live under, and it's the same thing that's happening in places like Palestine, it's the same thing that's happening in places like Afghanistan. You can make me a lie if you can explain to me why they call it surplus. But that's not surplus equipment that they have given to police departments in this country. That's a part of the whole military budget, includes the amount of resources that they're shooting into communities to control African people. That's not surplus. Surplus is that above and beyond which is necessary for a particular project. It's not surplus if you understand that the local police department is an extension of the same state apparatus that's functioning today in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. It's not surplus. That's colonialism. And that's the thing. That's what we talk about, a struggle. A revolutionary struggle is going to be necessary to free ourselves, to free our people, to unite the efforts of black people in this country with the struggle of oppressed people around the world who are attempting to overturn the same relationship. That's what we're engaged in. So lines are being drawn in the sand now, and I think it's extremely important. And so I'm so appreciative of the participation of these soldiers, you know, who come to us and share analyses and share their passions and understanding for freedom. And the other thing I'm appreciative of is that these are not hustlers that we are talking about here. And there are all these Negroes who run around our country, this country, hustling. You know, black people, they got a hustle going on. People here are genuinely concerned about the emancipation of our people and the peoples of the world. That's what it's about. And more than that, they are arrogantly convinced, as I am arrogantly convinced, that this world can be changed and we have the ability to change it, to overturn it, so that people don't have to be hustlers in order to survive.
Omali Yeshetela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition. The NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund wants the U.S. Justice Department to change the way it responds to fatal police use of force in Black America. Defense Fund Associate Director Janae Nelson says the federal government should investigate police killings of unarmed black people, not just when called upon, but every single time that it happens.
These recent events have brought to the fore many of the recommendations that we've supported for years, and some of them are newer ones based on technology, but they are all with the aim of ensuring that there is accountability within law enforcement for upholding constitutional rights, particularly when there seems to be evidence of racial bias. So the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund recently sent a letter to the Department of Justice asking that it take specific measures, and we articulated four different measures that we think will make a significant difference. First off is certainly to conduct a comprehensive review of all police-involved assaults and killings. The recent killings of, at this point, four different African-American males in the course of a little over a month have brought these instances to the fore. But as we all know, these are not, unfortunately, new events. That we've seen this most predominantly in the, or most noticeably when we saw the Rodney King beating many years ago, and there have been far too many deaths, assaults, and beatings in the interim. With that in mind, we are asking the Department of Justice to undertake a very comprehensive and thorough review of the assaults and killings of all unarmed individuals, with a particular focus on the killings of unarmed African Americans. Secondly, we're asking that the Department of Justice use its funds, use its grant process to incentivize local law enforcement to engage in stronger training around the issue of racial bias. And we don't mean just express bias and prejudice, but also implicit bias, subconscious racism that plays a significant factor into how police view these communities and the ways in which they interact with African American and other communities of color. We also want to make sure that the grant process funding is tied to the use of force, and to incentivize police departments to use force only in instances when it's necessary and not to abuse the power of its force, and certainly not in these instances where it arises in the murder of unarmed individuals. Third, we are asking that the Department of Justice hold police officers accountable to the fullest extent of the law, to the extent that any police officer has abrogated his or her duties as a public servant, to the extent that any police officer has exhibited racial bias, explicit or implicit, to the extent that any police or law enforcement officer has used excessive force against an unarmed individual, they should be investigated and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And we're asking that the Department of Justice keep that in mind in thinking about whether there are any federal civil rights charges to be brought or federal criminal charges to be brought in addition to any that may be brought on the state and local levels. And finally, in terms of new technology, one of the real game changers in the recent events that we've seen is the fact that there has been a recording of these incidents that we can actually see, as painful as it is to watch, the death and assault on Eric Garner, for example, that we have video of Miss Marlene Pinnock out of California who was brutally beaten by California Highway Patrol. And that has made a significant difference in capturing the evidence that's needed to hold these law enforcement departments accountable. So we are also asking the Department of Justice to encourage the use of police officer body-worn cameras. We think that having additional technology in play will allow for the gathering of evidence that can help substantiate claims of bias, of excessive use of force, and hopefully prevent the use of force, because law enforcement officers will be more mindful of their actions before they become deadly.
You're calling for a review of all police killings of unarmed individuals. Is that kind of an automatic trigger? And would the Justice Department be capable of such a larger role? There are a whole lot of such incidents in the United States.
Well, they certainly are capable of this kind of role. And I think when you have a concentrated number of such killings, particularly against a discrete minority group, it calls for such a comprehensive review. The potential and already mounting distrust of law enforcement in many communities of color is something that ought to be of concern not only to the Department of Justice, but to the American public as a general matter. It is important that we maintain a relationship of trust with law enforcement, and to the extent that that is being eroded by these tragic killings, the Department of Justice ought to step in and ensure that the public trust is well-founded and that there's no malfeasance on the part of law enforcement, and particularly if there is the exercise of racial bias.
But this would require a significant beefing up of Justice Department manpower.
Well, we're not asking that the Department of Justice engage in foot patrol. What we're asking is that the Department of Justice review these instances where unarmed individuals have been killed. I don't think that's too much of an undertaking to consider, particularly when we are asking that in the first instance it consider those killings that have an air of potential racial bias. As we know, this recent spate of killings of African-American males, and there again have been others that have involved African-American women as well, ought to be investigated. They are at this point far too prevalent. There's a significant amount of evidence demonstrating that there are concerns of over-policing in these communities, of broken windows policing, of racial profiling that has led to this disparate number of killings among African-Americans. And of course, we are concerned about any unarmed individual being killed by officers if it isn't justified.
Civil rights prosecutions against cops have a rather thin historical record of success.
And we hope to change that. That's true, and that is why one of the remedies that we're asking for is to be able to hold law enforcement to their accountability to the fullest extent of the law. Police officers are an invaluable feature of our society, and they are here to serve and protect, but they are also, like any other citizen of this country, bound by the laws of this country and are expected to uphold the civil and constitutional rights of all members of society.
Janae Nelson of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund in Washington. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, says what happened to Michael Brown is typical in the United States, and there should be 2, 3, and many more responses, such as in Ferguson.
For over a week, the media and millions of viewers and readers have been focused on the ever-changing events of Ferguson, Missouri, where a local teenager, Michael Brown, was shot to death by a white cop. What has been consistent and unchanging was the level of outrage among Ferguson residents, men and women who have resisted every attempt to silence or sidetrack their efforts, to achieve the arrest, prosecution, and conviction of a white cop, Darren Wilson, who shot and killed Mike Brown. They are fueled by fury and by a long train of police repression. They haven't let anything, promises, provocations, politicians, or police, turn them away from their objectives. The system has used weapons of war, sniper rifles, armored personnel carriers, submachine guns, and other implements of military violence to intimidate the people, to threaten the people, to silence the people. They only continued their marches for justice for Mike Brown. They faced sweet-talking politicians promising peace, police with dark faces promising protection, preachers praying for placidity, and they kept on marching. They were threatened with arrests if they broke curfew and received the acrid rain of tear gas, and they kept on marching, marching for justice for Mike Brown. A reporter for a national cable outlet asked five teens clad in baseball hats and bright red bandanas to identify themselves. One by one, they announced this name, Mike Brown. They were all Mike Brown. And as they march through fear, they are indeed Mike Brown, as are we all.
In New York City, the Police Reform Organizing Project has meticulously documented the racial bias that is inherent in the NYPD's crackdown on so-called quality of life offenses, such as jaywalking, holding an open container of beer, or selling loose cigarettes. Project Director Robert Ganji has written that stop and frisk, although abhorrent, was never the fundamental problem. Even more destructive and insidious, says Ganji, is the broken windows philosophy of policing, espoused by New York Police Commissioner Robert Bratton.
It's broken windows as it's applied in New York City. In other words, we don't necessarily disagree that social disorder should be addressed and we should have a civil society in our city. What we disagree with is how the city addresses issues of social disorder. It addresses it virtually only through the police department and only through punitive interactions with certain groups of people and mostly low-income people of color.
What you called an acute racial bias built into the practice of the NYPD.
Right. And we think the racial bias is undeniable and that the numbers demonstrate that. 89% of the people who are arrested for marijuana-related misdemeanors in New York City, for example, are people of color, even though all the research shows and people just generally know that white people use and smoke marijuana at the same, maybe even higher rates than people of color. We did a court monitoring project. In fact, we're continuing the court monitoring project in the fall where prop representatives went into the arraignment parts in New York City's criminal courts to observe and record who the police were arresting and on what charges. And 89% of the defendants we saw were people of color. Some days we'd go into a courtroom and every one of the defendants was a person of color. And most of the things that they were charged with were innocent or innocuous activities that a lot of people in society would not consider wrong or illegal if there wasn't some obscure provision of an administrative code that says it's illegal. So police arrest people in New York City for occupying two seats on the subway, even though it's 2 o'clock in the morning and there's nobody else on the subway car, for walking between subway cars, for jaywalking, for having an open alcohol container, for riding a bicycle on the sidewalk, for begging. They'll arrest street vendors who are 18 inches from the curb when they're supposed to be 20 inches from the curb. So far too much of the NYPD resources focuses on activities that are not criminal, that are not dangerous, that are not predatory, and they are activities that are being engaged in by people of color. And the senseless death of Eric Garner at the hands of the NYPD is a worst-case scenario of what could happen with the aggressive application of broken windows policing.
Because Eric Garner was accused of selling Lucy cigarettes.
Yes, which many people in his community, I'm sure, did not consider to be a criminal activity or an activity that warranted any kind of police response, and certainly not the kind of abusive police response that was applied to him.
You've got some fantastic figures, examples here. You say that between 2008 and 2011 in Park Slope, Brooklyn, which is a trendy neighborhood, only 8 people were given summonses for driving their bicycle on the sidewalk.
A bike on the sidewalk offenses, right.
But in Bed-Stuy, a black neighborhood, during that same period, 2,050 people got summonses for those kinds of offenses.
On a annual basis, that's exactly right.
Well, one of the things that you say is that this broken windows policing is connected with an aggressively enforced quota system, but obviously there is no quota system in Park Slope.
That's right. The quota system is enforced in certain communities in regard to certain people. And again, the numbers are deniable that demonstrate that. So that's part of the problem. Now, the solution is not to apply the quota system and aggressive policing to white communities. The solution is to develop different strategies for law enforcement and different strategies for dealing with civil disorder and different practices for dealing with social and economic problems so that the response to things like a young man having his foot up on the subway should not be to arrest that person, would be to say, hey, why don't you put your foot down? The response in terms of government policy should not be that the city sends its police force, individuals with guns and badges, to enforce civility on the subways, but you could have another government agency that takes care of that responsibility so that the people who are making too much noise on the subway or begging on the subway maybe get reprimanded in some way, but they don't become criminalized. They're not cuffed and confined and put through a demeaning court process. So there are strategies and reforms that are available to particularly Mayor de Blasio and Police Commissioner Bratton that could continue to address the social and economic problems that are very real in our city, but not address them through NYPD practices and tactics and through a law enforcement response.
And you've got 3 concrete suggestions for the police.
Right. One is to abolish the quota system. Right now, the way the quota system is applied and police officers follow it is the main way that the performance of police officers is assessed by the NYPD. And the quota system is based entirely on punitive interactions. Police officers get credit if they give out tickets, they make stops, or they make arrests. And what we've proposed, and other people who know these issues have proposed, is to build into a system for evaluating officer performance constructive interactions between the officers and the community. So an officer could get credit if they help settle a dispute or they break up a fight between teenage boys and send them home. An officer can get credit if he or she finds a mentally ill person or a homeless person sleeping under a stairwell of an apartment building, and instead of locking that person up, bringing that person to a local social service program that could help that person deal with his or her problem. And we think that system for evaluating police officers would lead to a much more constructive approach on the part of the police in the city.
And you've also suggested that the police get out of handing out summonses for petty kinds of behavior.
Right, and we've suggested that there are certain responsibilities that unfortunately the NYPD has, and it's not appropriate for them to be focused on those issues. So, for example, regulating street vendors, regulating pedicab drivers, regulating people like Eric Garner, who was accused of selling untaxed goods. All those responsibilities could be carried out more appropriately by other government agencies. It would be cheaper for the city, and the city would not be involved in criminalizing people as it is now, criminalizing people who are not actually engaged in criminal activities. And the antagonism that these practices generate are all too real. And Eric Garner as we saw at the beginning of the video, his attitude is, this stops today. Every time you see me, you mess with me. And there are many, many people of color who feel that way about the police. So where white middle-class people or white well-to-do people will see a police officer and feel safe, low-income people of color often have told us they see a police officer and they'll walk to the other side of the street because they worry about what any kind of interaction with a police officer could lead to.
And the third suggestion is to fire the cops who won't go along with the new order.
Yeah, well, Bratton should take great satisfaction in dismissing police officers who engage in such unjustified arrests as locking up somebody who's occupying two seats on a subway car at 2 o'clock in the morning, for locking somebody up who's jaywalking, for locking up the young man of color who was sitting on his stoop drinking a beer while listening to hip-hop music. To make the point by dismissing the officers who carry out that kind of activity, that the police department is not looking to harass and target people, particularly people of color, who are engaging in innocent and innocuous activity, which right now is the form that broken windows policing takes in New York City.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.